silence of the space. I'm trying to say that, you know, divine presence, the presence of God, may not always come as fully spectacular or sound or certainty. And sometimes the divine presence as, you know, kind of the vast spaciousness, you know, the clearing and the embracing that have us within it. It's not empty, but it's kind of openness that allows us to be present.
Is an associate teaching professor at Georgetown University, where she specializes in constructive theology and Christian spirituality. She recently published a fascinating and thoughtful book titled The Silent God and the Silenced: Mysticism and Contemplation Amid Suffering, a book that explores the implications of reckoning with God's silence for our spiritual and ethical lives. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Okay, so a couple of years ago, I taught a university course on divine silence, and the topic struck me as both timely and provocative. It's one that a lot of people in my faith tradition find both alluring and a little threatening. The course proved to be an amazing experience for me. I'll be teaching again soon, in fact, this fall. The next time I teach it, though, my students and I will have the benefits of learning from a book I only found after my first time teaching about divine silence. This book is titled The Silent God and the Silenced: Mysticism and Contemplation of Its Suffering, and its author is Mina Cho, who is with me today. So, Mina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this beautiful conversation, Matthew and Kate.
So I find the subject of the silence of God to be really provocative, powerful. What drew you to it personally, and what persuaded you to write a book about it?
I feel as if the topic kind of arrived in my life before I chose it. It sounds like a little bit cliche, but it actually, yeah, it does. As a learner of the mystical and contemplative tradition, and as a former member of a Roman Catholic religious community, silence has long been part of my prayer. The Religious of the Sacred Heart, my former community, formed me to see contemplation and the apostolic mission not as separate, but as just kind of one movement. But also, I mean, through my own pastoral engagement and encounters with the immigrants and racially marginalized people and women of color and the LGBTQI+ individuals, I saw that silence can be painful when it is, you know, imposed and forced. So I became interested in the tension between two silences, imposed and coercive silence on one hand, and mystical and contemplative silence on the other hand. So yeah, imposed silence wounds us. Mystical silence can open us for encounter with God. So I kind of wanted to hold two silences together. So silence can be grace, and silence can be also a weapon. So that tension drew me to the silence of God.
Okay, that's great. I love this idea about silences that open us, but also those that can close us, right? That can be imposed or coercive. Now, I'll ask this here at the end. You're from South Korea, is that right?
Yes.
And you teach at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And you mentioned early in the book that the cultures of South Korea and America view silence quite differently. I mean, can you explain? That's another dimension of this of silence here, then, the differences. Can you speak to that difference between American and say, South Korean cultures about silence?
Sure. I mean, I should be really careful not to make a sort of, you know, dichotomous, you know, distinction between the two cultures.
Yeah,
but
sure.
In American public culture that I have experienced, speech tended to be treated as how can I say, a kind of a proof of agency. So if you have not spoken, you have not really shown up, you have not like engaged it. And silence gets sometimes read as suspicious or timid or indifferent and complicit. Korean culture handles silence very differently. I think it's probably an influence from Buddhism and Confucianism. Excessive speech can be distrusted as a kind of evasion. So the ability to read a room or to attend to what is unsaid is always expected. So there are also the deeper words like if you are familiar with Han or Zhong, sort of accumulated emotions, whether shaped in grief or in deep affection, and those kind of emotions have never been allowed to have a full expression. So again, I do not want to romanticize either side. Korean culture has its own ways of weaponizing, silence against women and the vulnerable. And American directness has its own gift. But I guess the book lives in kind of in between space, so where each tradition helps each other, there's something together.
Okay, good. That good. That makes sense. I appreciate the distinction, but also not romanticizing or overly dichotomizing the difference. That seems wise to me. Let me ask you about this. At the beginning of the first chapter of your book, you clarify, I'm quoting here, that silence is not simply the absence of sound or speech. Rather, silence is a particular type of presence, which I found provocative. Can you explain what you mean when you describe silence as a type of presence?
Sure. That sense of silence as a presence is based on my own experience of prayer. When I say silence is a type of presence, I think I am kind of pushing back against the assumption that silence equals absence or the lack of speech or sound. And that assumption, I guess, is just everywhere in our politics, in our worship, and even in much of our theology. And I think maybe one of the useful analogies for silence is the presence of absence is music. So the pause and the rest between notes are not deficiencies of sound. If you remove them and you do not get music, it's just full of noise. And I think also something similar is true of space. So I use space as a metaphor for silence in the book, because space too is not mere emptiness, right? Space is what allows presence to appear and to breathe and to become sometimes relational. So a room is not meaningful only because of the objects placed inside it. It is meaningful because there is a space between them. So yeah, silence is a space. I'm trying to say that divine presence, the presence of God, may not always come as fully spectacular or sound or certainty. And sometimes the divine presence as kind of the vast spaciousness, the clearing and the embracing that have us within it. It's not empty, but it's kind of openness that allows us to be present.
I like that distinction a lot. I like that idea about evoking space as a kind of a way to think about silence. There are certainly people are familiar with spaces in which silence prevails. Like a lot of religious sanctuaries, right, are spaces of quiet and silence, and they're not anything but empty, right? And if you feel there's a sense of the holy or the sacred or the presence of God, it's not an empty feeling. There's a fullness to it, but it's a fullness that almost creates a response, a kind of reflexive response of kind of a hushed, a stillness, a deeper listening, right? Which is great. And in fact, this kind of thing, you point this out also in the book, it's all over scripture, right? There are some key biblical passages that emphasize the silence of God. And maybe we can review a couple of them here. The story of Elijah in the cave, like 1 Kings 19, a famous story of silence. Can you remind us of that one?
Yeah, that biblical narrative is one of the inspirations that motivated me to write this book.
Okay.
So it's a fascinating story. So there was wind and like a grandiose, the spectacular, so the earthquake and fire, but God was not in those scenes. And then God arrives in. I love the translation here, NLSV, sound of sheer silence.
Yeah.
And the King's Version says a still small voice, but I prefer, the sound of a sheer silence. I was just struck by that expression. What a fascinating oxymoron. What is this sound of sheer silence? So I had to figure out what it is. So, I studied and I also talked to my friend who is specialized in ancient Eastern language, and that word has a Ugaritic resonance. So it's not like lack of sound. It's more like a stifled cry. And so it's like a mother dog, like whimpering over her dying pup, like a trembling stillness. So that was kind of for me like aha moment. So God met Eliza not with spectacles, not with grandiose, but with a shared grief.
Yeah.
And yeah, through that encounter, Eliza goes from almost suicidal exhaustion to renewed mission. And so that was a great inspiration for me, the sheer silence, the sound of sheer silence.
Yeah, I love that. And that's really fascinating because, if you translate it as still small voice, which is the King James Bible, which a lot of people in my own tradition are familiar with, it suggests that the sound that comes there is a sound of inspiration. But you're teasing out some other nuances there with that sound of sheer silence. So it's not the same thing as a void or a vacancy or a vacuum. There's a fullness to it. But as your friend brought out, I love the notion of something that kind of whimpers with or consoles or mourns with, as though it's not necessarily a language being communicated, but more a shared space of mourning or grief,
Yeah, exactly.
which is really beautiful. I love that. You also point out that the book of Job, the story of Job, has got these silences that are inscribed into it, right? These kind of that could factor into it. Can you remind us of some of the silences that you find important in the book of Job?
Oh yeah, and I guess the Book of Job is one of the biblical books people feel sometimes really struggle hard to understand what the silence of God means. And I guess what looks significant for me is that the friend's confident speech didn't work. The reasonable answers to suffering and just didn't work there. What I found remarkable here is that the God who listens in silence. When Job cried, God did not stop him. God's long silence holds Job's protest as legitimate. And you see here a person struck by life's unexpected disaster, and just like and so many of us, and God allows him to protest, to speak, and his protest is legitimate, and God listens. Then eventually, God did not reserve Job's suffering, but I believe it's more likely God reframes the suffering.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And then when God speaks out of the whirlwind, out of the tempest right there in toward the back end of the chapter 38 or somewhere in the book of Job, then Job is expected to sort of come into quiet, right, in silence and to listen to God speak. So listening here in the silence is an important part of the exchange. And God does not appreciate, by the way, the answers of the friends. These are empty speech the friends have, right? I love silence in the book of Job. Take one more example. I find this one especially poignant, the story of Jesus being silent before his accusers. You described that one too.
Yeah, I mean, in the gospel stories, there are many occasions of silence. And what I kind of distinguish it is the silence of Jesus and silence in Jesus. And silence of Jesus, I interpreted it as kind of his own choice not to speak. So Jesus was silent before the high priest and Pilate. And I didn't see it as a passivity. It's more likely a refusal to be assimilated into the categories of the powerful. This kind of silence reveals Jesus as a witness. And I also explored it further in another chapter, naming it as a defiant silence. And it's the kind of the power that refuses to perform on power's term. So that's what I named, but I actually borrowed the term from the Canadian philosopher Paul Ouch. And silence in Jesus is a little bit different. Now, in many stories in the Bible, in the gospel, Jesus retreat himself into a quiet place before he meet people, before he does his own mission. And this silence prepares him to the manifestation of the love of God, to be the manifestation of the love of God. So the silence we encounter in his prayers, his own prayer disposition toward God. He makes a space of silence for himself to listen to God. So that's what I named silence in Jesus. I borrowed the term from the philosopher.
Okay, I like that distinction and the silence of Jesus and the silence in Jesus. I just finished reading the Gospels myself, and this time I read them with your book in mind. And there are a lot of really great silences in the Gospels. And I was thinking even the parables have got an aspect of silence to them, right? It's spoken, it's described, but the truth is somewhat behind what is spoken. The profundity of the parable is what goes unsaid. Right? So there's a silence laced in and through the speaking, even these parables. I was finding all these new silences, Mina, because of your book. So yeah, which I appreciated very much. Come back to the title of your book, The Silent God and the Silenced. You spoke earlier about the difference between these silences that are those that open us to the mystery and the relationship with God. Then there are those that are more silences that close us down, that are coercive silences, right? That force us into silence. And you argue that silence, of the coercive variety, it's gendered and racialized and classed, right? Which is obviously problematic, to put it mildly. But you do talk in the book about instances when some underrepresented or marginalized group was able to convert silence into an instrument of social as well as spiritual response. So I wonder if you could sort of give an example. How's an example of a group that's marginalized and silenced that converts that silence into a form of strength?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I like to share an example I originally considered for the book, but ultimately left out. This is something, it happened during the protest following the 2014 Sewol ferry disaster, which I described in the book. So you have to remember first that these parents who lost their children have been met with total neglect by the government back then. With them, and the government refused a full investigation and tried to silence their voices. And then after that disaster, when Pope Francis visited Seoul that summer, just a few months later, nearly 1 million people packed Gwanghwamun Plaza. And the atmosphere, you could imagine, was intense. In the sea of the people, like millions of people, everyone was seeking something, higher and louder and shouting and just desperate to be noticed by the Pope. The parents also sought to be noticed. but they were just a small group among a million people. So the grieving parents did something remarkable I would never forget. They sat on the ground and remained absolutely silent. In a crowd where everyone was trying to scream over one another, that silence created a haunting vacuum. It was so piercing, and it forced the Pope to stop his motorcade, and he just got out and held the parents' hands. And he chose to listen to the very people the state had ignored. And later, he was leaving back to the Vatican, and he left us with those unforgettable words and quote. And this is what the Pope said: "In the face of human suffering, one cannot remain neutral." So I think it's an example how, the silent the gesture, the action could make a profound response.
That's really quite a story. That ferry disaster you're describing, remind us, that took how many lives? It was the lives of, there were some adults, but lots of children that were lost on that ferry disaster. What was the death toll, do you remember?
306. More 300, 300 people. The exact number. Yeah, 300. I mean, the majority of the victims were high school students on their way to go to the field trip.
That's so awful. But what a response from those parents, right? When the Pope was present to sort of sit on the ground in silence as being the very thing that would bring attention to their suffering and their need for some kind of response, right, from the government, or in this case, from the Pope. It's an amazing story. It reminds me of there are these categories that you separate out in the book. There are three kinds of silence as forms of social protest that you elaborate on, right? You call one of them paradoxically loud silence, right? And then there's another one called melancholic silence. And the third you referred to earlier, it's defiant silence. So what's the difference between these modes of silence, loud, melancholic, and defiant?
Yeah, I mean, I believe there should be many different types of silences. These three are just, I named in the book. And I thought loud silence is more likely paralanguage, the moans and chants and hummings, and the body itself, praying, when words will not carry the weight. And I think Barbara Holmes, in her book, Joy Unspeakable, beautifully describes the power of this loud silence. It is not noise, but not speech, but it's a deeper expression than speech could be. So that was loud silence I named. And melancholic silence is what happens when you have been kind of uprooted from your own mother tongue, which is also my own experiences, and that kind of pushes into a language that is not yours. So there is a sense of loss. There is also, kind of creativity. Yeah, it's what emerges is a dissonant mixture that unsettles the sort of the supposed unity of the dominant language. So it could, sometimes sound like broken language, but there is a creativity. You make sense of your own and you communicate. Yeah. And that is melancholic silence. And defiant silence is, I guess, a deliberate refusal to let one's testimony be absorbed into a system that will use it against you. So I used the example from Harriet Jacobs in the book, and what Jesus does before the high priest and Pilate, and what many witnesses who refuse to speak in unjust court. So yeah, this is what I thought as defiant silence.
Okay. These are really great, I think, distinctions, the loud, melancholic, and defiant silence, to show kind of ways in which silence can be converted into a really eloquent form of expression, right? Mm-hmm. That involves not only language, but gesture, the expectation to, or the failure to meet expectations for a certain kind of language, which becomes then kind of a very conspicuous silence, conspicuous, you know, either whether loud, melancholic, or defiant, right? No, it's great. I like that a lot. Can I ask you about the spirituality of silence, and specifically about something you say about prayer? You reflect on something I find that's important and it's powerful. You write this. You say, while vocal prayer has its strength, it can also distract one from meditating on the mystery that opens in silence. And I guess I'm wondering here what form silent prayer takes for you, and how do you decide when to pray vocally and when to pray silently?
Oh, yeah. Another early inspiration that motivated me to write this book was Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day. And in the poem, and she writes, you know, I don't know exactly what a prayer is, but then, you know, she asks, I do know how to pay attention. So I just loved that line. And I think these lines also express what I believe as the essence of a prayer. So attention is the act of emptying, you know, ourselves and turning our whole presence towards something beyond ourselves. So that object of attention, you know, could be the beauty of nature, the scripture in Lectio Divina, you know, students I'm teaching, and or even the cat I'm living with. So in the stillness of looking deeply, you know, I learned to find God in those things, and eventually to let God find me through all things. So I would say that's my understanding of prayer. And I think it looks, you know, in practice, you know, quite ordinary, you know, morning sitting, you know, just, you know, Lectio Divina, as I said, and attentive walking, and even the afternoon running. And I'm reminded that, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh once said that when he was asked when he actually prayed, and his answer was all the time, every moment. So that was the silent prayer for my practice. And vocal prayer is, I guess, what I do, and I needed to articulate to myself what I'm carrying inside. And sometimes I do not know what is within me until I say it aloud. The silent prayer is what I do, and I need to be carried, and it's a movement of God. And then I have nothing to add. And I think, you know, both prayers, vocal prayer and silence prayer, are real prayer. Neither is more advanced than the other.
Okay, yeah, I think that's great. I myself often will blend the two. I find now in my religious community, when you pray publicly, you're praying usually vocal prayer, right? You're kind of summoning kind of a common collective spirit of the community and in invoking God. But in my own private prayers, I often will begin with something that is vocal, or at least semi-vocal. It's voiced maybe in my head, looking to sort of figure out something that will allow me to be able to sort of open myself to God. Once I'm able to sort of make the connection, then I will very intentionally fall silent as I can be in my head, and just allow myself to be as much as I can be close to God in that moment, so that I don't speak over whatever I might receive, right? That's the important thing about it, about being silent, is that one can receive more fully if one's not speaking noise over the top of whatever one might receive. Yeah, I love that.
Exactly, thank you.
Now, the subtitle of your book, again, the title of the book, The Silent God and the Silenced, which I bet that's a great title. The subtitle is Mysticism and Contemplation Amid Suffering. How do you understand the relationship between those two terms, mysticism and contemplation?
Yeah, that I have quite a lot of conversations with my fellow theologians, because there is kind of a caution to just distinguish mysticism from contemplation. So what I meant makes sort of distinction between the two is that, you know, first of all, I believe that they belong together, not two different things, but they are expressed and experienced in different way. So mysticism, if I just, you know, simply say, it's a dimension of experience. So it is the encounter with the mystery of God, what surpasses in a concept or image. Contemplation is more likely for me a dimension of disposition. So it's a sustained way of attending, you know, quality of presence you carry into ordinary life. You know, I follow Karl Rahner and Dorothy Jolle. You know, they say that, you know, mysticism is not elite and it is not for spiritual masters. The mystical is at the core of all human experiences, and I follow their insight. I know you have, you know, mystical moments, and, you know, not named them as such, but mystical moments is everywhere. Contemplation is what makes those moments fruitful, I believe. And without a contemplative disposition, mystical experience can be a spike. And you just, you know, constantly, you know, seek for just stimulation and intense and then gone. And with contemplative disposition, I believe it becomes a way of life. So, yeah.
I love that, right? So this past weekend, my wife and older daughter and I visited our younger daughter who lives in Montana. And she took us on this beautiful hike in the mountains behind where she lives in Missoula. And I could say that, you know, when I was there, actually, I was having, I call it a mystical appreciation of the wonder of nature and of God's creation of nature, and an appreciation of it. It was a spike moment. It was a kind of a peak experience moment. But contemplation is a way of attending, where you're able to sort of carry the spike or the peaks into a broader sense of meaning, to kind of allow other parts of life to cohere in relation to those moments of peak experience, or spikes, as you put it, right? So contemplation is what unifies these moments into a larger coherent whole, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great distinction, Mina. I really appreciate that. Now, I was taking note in your book of some of the spiritual benefits of silence, and I'm going to quote a couple of passages here that you write, and then ask you about them here. Here's one thing you say. You say, silence trains our ears and mind to rearrange our relation to the whole by offering a heightened awareness of the spatial whole, as well as of the subtle things that otherwise remain unseen and unheard by our sensory organs. Here's a second quote. Silence helps us unfold at a pace that prepares us for the deeper and more poignant insights arising in tune with others who suffer together. Silence challenges our tendency to quickly articulate the meaning of tragic loss, and instead directs our attention toward the voices underneath and the visions beyond. Again, beautiful. One more passage. Silence helped mystics to be more attuned to their inexhaustible desire for God and journey with love instead of defining the voice of God. Now, I really like these descriptions. That first is about how silence helps attune us more deeply to the world around us. And the second, it's how silence attunes us to others. And the third, it's how silence connects us more deeply with God. And I'm wondering, do you undertake exercises of silence with your students? When you teach, I'm teaching a class on divine silence in the fall. When you teach this class, how do you impart these things as concepts, or are they also practices like in the classroom?
I think I take as a more practice when I teach in classroom. I mostly teach undergraduate students, and I have been incorporating contemplative practices into my classroom. So every class, you know, I open a class with a few minutes of silence, sometimes just 1 minute. It's just a breathing exercise before any discussion. And silence, it's an interesting experience on my side too. Students, at the beginning, they feel they have some kind of discomfort. They are not used to silence. Not just lack of sound, but more likely constant feed of all those social media. Silence is not the part of the rhythm of their life. But once they get used to this silence practice, it's just a few minutes in every class, they just love it. And this even sometimes remind me, Professor Joe, I mean, can you practice, can you just have a few moments of silence together? And I think I sense of a thirst there. I mean, they know that silence creates space inside, and through it and in it, they can notice each other. They can also notice the deeper desire in their heart. They can also be aware of the anxiety inside. So silence is a big part of my teaching.
I really appreciate that. As you were saying that, I was looking over at Kate, the producer, who's a student here at BYU, a former student of mine, excellent student, Kate is. And Kate was kind of nodding her head about what you were saying about silence. Yeah, and I was thinking to myself, I should do more of that. I should not so anxiously fill the space, Mina, as I do sometimes. I'm gonna make a point to make more space for silence in my teaching this fall. You're inspiring me here.
You need it. Thank
So I've got to ask you about this. I love how you address in your book the 3 days of Easter, focusing especially on that middle day, right? Holy Saturday, the day between the crucifixion and the resurrection. Christians naturally gravitate toward Easter as commemoration of Christ's resurrection, understandably so, right? But you point out that there's a spiritual and ethical problem of obscuring the other 2 days of the Easter Triduum, right? The Friday and the Sunday, Friday and the Saturday. You write this, I'm quoting you here. While conventional readings of the empty tomb account present the silence as a rhetorical device of the gospel author to highlight the significance of the resurrection, such a triumphalist reading largely ignores the traumatic experience of the disciples who were left without even the body of their loved one, Jesus, to mourn. Okay, that's a great point, right? That when we rush to the Easter triumph, we run right over the top of the experience of the initial disciples. Now, if we don't rush in our worship to the significance of Resurrection Sunday, but if we allow ourselves to linger with the traumatic, confusing effects of Holy Saturday, what, in your view, do we have to gain spiritually, right? In what ways might such attention to Holy Saturday bring us closer, not only to those who suffer, but also to God?
I guess a great deal, and we lose a great deal when you just rush past it. As I quote it in the book, the conventional readings treat the silence of empty tomb as sort of rhetorical device, a pause, necessary pause that sets up the resurrection. But I believe that triumphalist reading ignores something crucial and something real, and so many of us actually go through in our lifetime. And I see the disciples as a trauma survivors, and their experience, as I have worked with some of the trauma survivors, the words do not help. The ability to hold the strength is a great deal there. And disciples were left without, even a body to mourn, and they could not perform the basic acts of grief. So before the empty tomb, they just waited without any anticipation of resurrection. And even though Jesus repeatedly say he will come back, but they just didn't understand. And I think many of us experience something like this in our life journey. So yeah, I drew on my colleague, theologian Shelley Rambo, and who calls Holy Saturday as a theology of remaining, and survivors of trauma live in that space between life and death. We cannot just simply move forward, and we cannot just simply heal. And then what is important also I found there is here is interpretation of von Balthasar drawn from the tradition that what God was what Jesus was doing in that silence, Christ descended to the discarded and to those for whom all the sources of hope, have been, just exhausted. And Jesus was there with them. And so I believe Holy Saturday is not a pause, so not like, just an empty space, but it is the day God chose to be, just fully present with the abandoned. And then, also invite us to listen to our heart that we ourselves abandoned and did not pay attention. And so, reach out to those who were, displaced and abandoned by the society, and our heart goes there. I think that's the significance of Holy Saturday.
That's really beautiful. I love your words here about the empty tomb. You write, "The empty tomb is a space of mystical and contemplative silence that beckons us to bear confusion and uncertainty and to remember our pains and losses instead of hastily seeking glorious victory in the way we anticipate it." I just finished reading a novel, and one of the characters in the novel is a kind of a holy person, a person of God, who makes it a point to try to bear the suffering of others and to bear it as opposed to speaking words that try to heal it instantly. They just sit in silence. This character sits in silence with other people. And it's, the narrator in the novel points out that this had an effect of helping others to feel better even when nothing was said and even when it didn't take away the condition. They felt that person bearing the suffering with them, and that's what really made the difference, and which I thought was beautiful. And it kind of, for me, it resonates with what you're saying here about the importance of not running past trauma, but not running past suffering, but remaining with it, having the courage to remain with it, right, and to lean into it, which also brings more significance finally to the resurrection. What it actually does, if you can't sort of be redeemed from a suffering you won't acknowledge or admit, right? You can't appreciate a Christ who doesn't come to actually save you from something. So, yeah, that's wonderful, Mina. Thank you. So,
Thank you.
a couple last questions here for you. So, we live in a loud world, right? Especially these days, it's a loud, loud world, a world suffused with vehement words and hot images. And do you think of silence as antithetical to such noise, or is it more accurate to say that silence is indifferent finally to that kind of noise, almost unrelated to the noise of everyday life? Is it fair to make a distinction that's that clean and neat? You did mention there are different forms of silence, there are different silences. But I guess I'm wondering if silence is a response to the world of noise finally for you, or if silence is another order from the world of noise.
That's an interesting question indeed. I saw the relation between silence and noise. I don't think, silence is antithetical to the noise or indifference. If silence is antithetical to noise, then noise, I think, it still stays at the center. And then silence is just its opposite. And we create, another set of dichotomy there. That keeps the loud world setting the terms. So if silence is indifferent to noise, then silence is a kind of retreat. So it implies that the spiritual response to a loud world is just to leave the room, which doesn't help anything. So I think I want to put in a different way. Silence is the ground from which noise and all the sound emerges. And to which they all return. So I would say silence is a different register, not a different volume. So if it makes sense.
That does make sense. I love that. Different register, not different volume.
So that engaged silence of someone listening hard at the suffering of the world is, and I think it's in its own way. It's much more powerful than most speech, and it is responsive rather than oppositional. So that's I think about the sort of the relationship between noise and silence.
Good, good. That resonates. I like that. Thank you,
you.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation how you felt that you were in some ways prepared to write about silence. I'm interested in what, if anything, you feel you're being prepared to write about next. I mean, is life as a scholar, as a life of thinking and writing, is the subject you think you're being prepared to write about now at all related to silence, or is it something very different?
Oh yeah, I'm actually writing my second book, and I shared the proposal with some of my colleagues, and they said that there is a kind of a family resemblance between the first book and second book. So it's somehow there is a running theme. The book I'm writing is tentatively titled as Mystical Patiency. It's a theology within the ruins of agentive control, and that's the subtitle. So in that book, I want to explore how the suffering endured by the mystics themselves can speak to the real violence of our world today. So more specifically, I'm asking whether mystics' language of self-renunciation or self-emptying can honestly meet the lives of those who have been displaced and dispossessed. So without romanticizing, their suffering, while reducing it to a spiritual metaphor. So yeah, it's continuous.
Well, if it's anything like, it sounds great. If it's anything like this first book, it'll be beautiful and make a great contribution.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mina. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And I've learned so much from your book, and I'm so grateful for it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.